Dear listeners, welcome to the Public Perception of Science podcast.
My name is Lieven Heremans.
And mine is Bram Harkema.
As you might know, the role of academic research in society is undergoing some serious discussions at the moment. For us as students, this discussion was actualized by last year's Maagdenhuis appropriation in Amsterdam. We feel the need to investigate and reflect academically upon the public perception of science and academia. Therefore, we set up this lecture series at Utrecht University in early 2016.
The guest lectures you will hear in this series come from different Dutch universities and have different disciplinary backgrounds. All speakers have in some way attributed to this discussion.
In this first lecture, you will hear Bas Haring, Professor of Public Understanding of Science at Leiden University. In this lecture, he emphasizes the importance of using metaphors to explain complicated scientific insights to a wide audience. If you want to have a look at the images he's talking about, please visit De Omslag, the website where this podcast is published. You can find the link in the podcast description.
We apologize for the audio quality, as Mr. Haring's clothes interfered with the microphone. It'll be better in the coming lectures.
Okay, thank you so much. I see my PhD thesis there, which is very odd, since that's something they typically are ashamed of. You know, it has no relation at all with what I'm currently doing. Thanks for the intro. I'm considered to be a philosopher indeed, although I studied artificial intelligence here in Utrecht. And actually, when you look out of the window, you stand here, I think you can see the house where I live. No, you hardly, but I live just 50 meters from this particular room for years, actually, around the corner, literally. And, I cannot do this because of the sound, isn't it? Yeah, I normally would like to do this, but okay, just put my hands in my zakken. Please interfere continuously. Yeah, if you want to ask questions or say things, it's nicer that you respond to me and I respond on what you say than that I just tell something. what I really like is, and it's just a hobby of mine, is to find forms that explain something quite complex from a scientific point of view to a wide audience. That's what I like. And luckily, I am professor in that field now. And I'm just given that position, to be honest. I'm not a professor who publishes a lot in scientific articles. I don't do that. But the former dean of my faculty liked my children book. Okay, so it's a kid's book that I wrote 15 years ago. He liked it and he said, okay, I'm going to retire. I'll make you professor and I'll give the university a problem. That's really how I get my position. But it should be clear that it's also the kind of information I'm giving you. I'm giving you experience information and not academic information. Yeah, I have no clue how to communicate science for a wide audience. I just do it. Yeah? And that's actually, you have two ways of interpreting a position in the public understanding of science. One is you do it, and that's the way I like to do it. Or two is you study it, and I go for the first approach. I like to take a subject of which I think it's required that people understand this better, and then I somehow try to find forms that explain that scientific content such that everyone can understand that, can understand it. Children, but also grown-ups and even colleague professors. And actually, really believe that that if you take forms that are extremely simple, but is something going on? I see you nodding.
No, I was just checking which students are and aren't
here. Ah, okay. Okay, something is going on. if you take the proper form that is scientifically correct, but it is still extremely simple, then I believe that you also can have academic effect. And that's what I really like to do. You know, I like to find such simple forms that the academics who own the field say, yeah, this was really, you explained this very fine. And a kid 9 years old says, yeah, I now understand how things work. That's what I personally aim for. And I'm just going to stroll through a couple of examples I find inspiring. Yeah, that was what I planned to do today. And many of these examples are graphical, but I will also have some textual examples. And in that case, you just have to look at the previous picture. So this is actually the first picture, just to show you what kind of things I like. This is the only graphical picture in The Origin of Species by Darwin. You know, it's a textbook, we all know that, it's text, and this is the only image. I don't think it's made by Darwin himself, but it depicts the evolution of, or it depicts time, and you see the history of life over time, and time is from the bottom to the top, and you see that life itself, or the history of life, can be envisioned as a tree, the tree of life. That's the name of this picture. And it's a very simple picture. We all know a tree. We know the concept tree out of our daily lives. We immediately understand, or at least we easily understand, that time goes from the bottom to the top. And you see that diversity grows over time. Yeah, that's an immediate implication of this simple image. But moreover, quite complex conclusions can be drawn from this image that are quite difficult to draw from text. For example, this image immediately makes clear that humans and, for example, chimpanzees have a common ancestor, because a tree, you know, a tree, well, splits these branches. They split, and if you go back, you will always find a point where any leaf or branch, you know, comes together with another one. Yeah, always. So the conclusion that chimpanzees and human beings share a common ancestor is immediately clear from this image. Moreover, it should be immediately clear that human beings and lettuce, or cows, or fungi also share a common ancestor because of the same image. And that conclusion, lettuce and human beings share a common ancestor, is a strange conclusion that you won't immediately draw from just text, but this picture, pats, immediately makes it clear. I like that. That's the kind of things I like to make. Yeah? And I make these things graphically sometimes, and I make these things via text when I write books, for example, for children. Clear? Clear why I like this example? And to indicate that such examples not only influence lay people, but also influence colleague scientists, I show you the next example just to make that point. That is this one. This is an example that we all know. This is the periodic table from chemistry. These are the elements that we know, and they're structured in this table. Actually, this table is nothing more than a graphical representation of scientific knowledge. And the idea behind this table is that if you put specific elements underneath each other, then that means that they share properties. So that is scientific knowledge somehow graphically, well, explained, and that it's just the graphical representation that gives it its understanding, or it helps us to understand stuff. But it's actually this is a similar thing as the image before. Just a graphical representation of data. And this image strongly influenced science, clearly. Yeah, it's clear that people from chemistry are extremely helped by this graphical representation. And it's nothing more than just a graphical representation. Yeah, so it's actually nothing more than just a way to communicate knowledge to a wide audience. But the audience in this case was also people from the field itself. I strongly believe in that. I strongly believe that if you take knowledge and you somehow communicated such that it's understandable for everyone, it also becomes understandable for scientists themselves. And I have to say that, otherwise I cannot have my job at the university. Since at the university you are supposed to tell stories that are relevant for colleagues. And it's actually just, it would be forbidden if I just wrote down children books. But now I argue that if you write also good children books, it might be relevant for colleagues. Yeah. Depends on who. No, not all my colleagues. It would be very strange if all my colleagues would agree on any on anything. Yeah. I believe that most people like what I do, they realize that it should not be the case that everyone at the university works like I do. But gedogen is a nice word. I don't know how to translate that. It's possible that there is no English translation for the Dutch word gedogen. It's somehow halfly allow. It's just something like that. Allow a little bit. So I am allowed a little bit. But they still find it okay that I walk around at the university and I might call myself professor. But maybe that stops. I don't know. Yeah. But I like what's going on? Tolerate. Yeah, I'm tolerated. That's probably the proper word. Yeah, I'm tolerated. Yeah. But I just like what I do. And I like to talk about it, so that's why I'm also here. What I want to show you now is actually the image, or the two images I'm most proud of if I look back in my own career. So I do this kind of stuff for say, 15 years now. So I tell stories, and I write down books, and I make images once in a while. And there is one image I'm particularly proud of, and it's actually quite funny. 15 years later, you think, okay, it's actually one of the first images I ever made. So that's also, I should stop maybe. and it's this one. It's from this children book, and it's actually, it's two images. So it's this one and the other one. And actually, the other one that's really intriguing, I think. now time goes from the top to the bottom. So time does not go from bottom to top as in the previous one. So this is the more normal fashion. Yeah, normally times go from top to bottom. But in this case, we are used to seeing trees from a trunk and then it goes up. So that's why it's depicted in this way. In our language, time goes from top to bottom. So here we have three time slices. In the first, and you need text to understand this, yes? The text is written underneath as an illustration, but I tell you now. on the top, you see time slice one. It's a bunch of chicken, and there's one super chicken, and the super chicken has special properties that the other chicken do not have. It's just by pure luck this chicken got those properties. Now we get time slice two. That's just the middle one. It's clear that super chicken has an easier life than the other chicken because of its super properties. And as a consequence of that, it will grow older and will have the opportunity to get offspring. So it's clear that in time slice two, a little bit later after number one, we will have more super chicken. Clear, isn't it? It's completely intuitive immediately, I would say. And if you wait a longer time, you see that there's only super chickens left and maybe one not super chicken, but it will be only super chicken. And this is just the process of evolution. This is the process of natural selection, which is depicted in this very easy, completely understandable way, I would say. This is not really the one I'm proud of. The one I'm proud of is a version of this that tells a story that has meanings in daily lives, I think. That's this one. And it's really the picture of which I think, yeah, okay, that's a cool thing. This picture was actually shown on TV in a children program, and it's the same two moments. First you have moment one in the past, and it shows bears. There are two kinds of bears in this picture. One type likes sex, and the other one does not like sex. They think, okay, well, what the heck, you know, I do other things. I'm in the grass, and I'm just having a fine time. I don't care so much. It's completely evident, if you relate this picture to the previous one with the super chicken, that give it some time, and only the horny bears, they remain. The other ones, they will vanish. Yeah, so they won't survive over time. After a while, you only have the ones who like sex. And it's immediately clear, for me at least, and I hope also for other people, that you now see there is a process that has as a natural consequence that only sex-liking animals survive. But it is not so that you can draw the conclusion that animals have sex in order to survive. But that sentence is a sentence that many lay people would use. They would say, animals have sex in order to survive. But if you look at this image, you immediately see that it's an untrue sentence. And I think that's an important understanding for lay people, that they suddenly realize, if they see this picture, hey, okay, there's just a process going on, and this process has as a very clear result that only the ones who proliferate and multiply themselves, well, they're the ones that are still around. But it does not mean that there's intention in this process. It's a result of the process. And actually, I think that's an important insight for many people, and I hope to have helped that with that image. Yeah.
I wonder, how do you deal with, let's say, deviations from this idea or the complexity of it? For instance, I was thinking with the previous picture of the survival of the fittest. Of course, it's totally clear for me that it explains the idea of the survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, if you look at how current do
you
say procreation? Yeah, that's the word, right?
Forplanting? Yeah, well, for planting, yeah, well.
Yes, I'm thinking, well, yeah. If we look at today, that there are a lot of people with, let's say, higher education, that do have less children because they have different ideas, different concerns, and you see often when, if we look at, very general, in Africa, people get a lot of children because that's their way of surviving.
Yeah.
And also, I would say here that if you do not have all these ideas whether you want to have children or not, you just live a little bit of a more simple life, you easier get children.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether the people who get the most children are also the fittest in terms of physical health and so on. So that's a sort of complexity which comes to mind if I see this. And the other picture.
Can I already give two comments on what you say? One, you must realize that this process of natural selection, as is depicted here, is a process that holds for creatures and not so much for human beings, at least not for human beings living now. Since we know this process and we can reconsider our own future, that's not in this. So please do not put this process too much on human beings. Our past, well, for the evolution of our past, indeed, it went through natural selection. But nowadays, it's a little different. And two is, don't mistake the word fit. Fit actually has in Dutch a different meaning than it has in English. Fit means something that it suits. Yeah, that is, and it doesn't mean that you're strong. Actually, fit, technically, in biology, just means the one who has the most offspring. That's active inclusive fitness. That's the word for it. So the more offspring you have, the more offspring you have. That's actually what this theory says. It's extremely clear. But now you can move on to the next picture and give your second or your other comment.
Yes, can we...
Yeah?
I just got this idea that I'm just going to say it, and you can say it's not relevant or something. But without the things that you added by text, I was looking at this image, and I think it also is able to tell something else, namely, in the first picture, you see, let's say, having sex is just one of the things you can do. So it's a certain idea about how a community lives, or sex is also a pleasure. And in the second one, it's only confined to having sex. So I'm thinking about there are also people who do not.
It's not about people, huh?
Oh, it's not about people now. It's about species.
Although, well, let me discuss it a little bit more. It should be, what I try to do is I try to find the simplest form that does its job. So, but it always requires some explanation. You can hardly ever do without text. Hardly ever. Even the picture of the Tree of Life by Darwin itself needed text. And it's a very careful process of being oversimplifying. But it's a risk you should take. You shouldn't try it. You must try it, since otherwise it's way too complex and you cannot tell your story. So it's your duty, I would say, or it's my duty, to try the most simple form that does its job, and it requires extra text. It's always the case. And what my aim is with this picture is just to show in a very efficient fashion, or that was what I aimed for, that the sentence, animals have sex in order to survive, or in order for their species to survive, is an untrue sentence. And that's a relevant, and that's also a relevant sentence in our lives, since I have had colleagues, and actually that was the reason for me to make these drawings at all and to write this book, that when I was doing my PhD, and I was living here around the corner, I had a colleague, I did my PhD in computer science, I had a colleague, and she said to me, some of my friends are gay, but being gay is unnatural. And such a sentence is logical if you consider this aim in surviving. Yeah, that's what she somehow, in the back of her mind, assumed, that there is an aim in surviving. And this picture shows that there's not an aim in surviving. Surviving is a consequence of the fact that you have creatures that multiply themselves and creatures that do not multiply themselves, and only the creatures that multiply themselves, well, they proliferate, and that's the kind of stuff that survives. But there's no aim in surviving. And it's quite an essential insight, I would say. Clear? Enough for this one? But do you understand what kind of things I like?
Yeah? Do you sometimes also find that sort of there is a danger of the pictures getting separated from your text and that they start living their own life?
Actually, I hardly ever make pictures. I just normally write. But in some cases, pictures are very efficient, and then I use pictures to make stuff clear. I'm going to switch to another example, yeah? Since I'm just going to quit some, or to overslant some example. Oh, this one, yeah. This is a combination of pictures and words that I like this one myself very much. And actually, you first should see only the left one, and then the right one. And this one, to me, shows what you can do with form besides text. And what the picture on the left tries to explain is, suppose that you have a vacuum cleaner. Suppose that that's the case. Don't read the stuff yet. Yeah, just see it in the background. Suppose you have a vacuum, there is a vacuum cleaner. You have no clue what it is or what it does. And so you must consider yourself not knowing anything of vacuum cleaners. And you have the question, what is it? You know, or how does it work? What does it do? Then what scientists do, they tear it apart. Yeah, that's what they naturally do. If they want to understand something, they tear it apart. Yeah? It's clear, you know, that's a very good scientific procedure to tear stuff apart. But there are two dangers in that process. And let me dwell a little bit on it. So what you do, you tear the vacuum cleaner apart until you have components that are such that you can understand the components individually, and then in your head you rebuild the vacuum cleaner, and if you have done so, you've understood the vacuum cleaner. Yeah, and you know what it is. Since if you have teared it apart until to the level of the smallest particle that you can understand, then you're done, I would say. Yeah? You understand the vacuum cleaner. The risks are the following: that you might think halfway in this process that none of the components that's the vacuum cleaner, of which the vacuum cleaner is composed, has, I would call it, suction power. But I don't know if that's an English word, zuigkracht. Suction power? Is that it's the power a vacuum cleaner has, yeah? To suck, that's what it does. Suction power. Yeah? And none of the components has suction power. So you might draw the conclusion that a vacuum cleaner has no suction power, because the individual components have no suction power. We immediately see that this is an incorrect conclusion. And you shouldn't say that because suction power is a property of the vacuum cleaner and not a property of the components of the vacuum cleaner. So it's an invalid conclusion. So anyone who says vacuum cleaners have no suction power because the components have no suction power, draw an untrue conclusion. Yeah, very clear. Second danger of this process is that you can go too much into the details. Suppose you want to understand the vacuum cleaner and you reach a level of, say, the paper bag inside. And you think, hey, maybe the secret of the vacuum cleaner is in the kind of fabric that they use to make this paper bag. And you take a microscope and you start studying the paper of the paper bag. And clearly, you are not learning anything of the vacuum cleaner. Yeah, that's a second, mistake you can make in this process. When I explain this with vacuum cleaners, you even stare at me, okay, I understand this. When I was six, I could understand this. Why the heck do you try to explain this simple stuff to us? But then you make another version of this picture, and that's a white one. And then we don't have a vacuum cleaner, but a person. And we ask the question, how come that Peter is so sad, yeah, for example? And you can map that process to the process on the left immediately. And what are scientists going to do if they want to answer that question? Well, they tear Peter apart. Well, what's the name? Is it Peter? Oh, this is a Dutch one. I do also have an English one, but it's Peter actually here. Peter. You tear Peter apart, and you go look in the components of Peter. In this case, you're going to look into his brain. Yeah, that's what scientists do if they want to understand the sadness of people. Not particularly of Peter, but if they want to understand such phenomenon in general. It's typically what they do. They tear the stuff apart. So are they going to look, they're going to peek in the brain of Peter, into the components of Peter. But then you have this problem that you had there, you have it here too. There are people who say, well, words that you use for Peter, like sadness, or what kind of personality, or what kind of words you would use, are actually irrelevant words because the components of Peter are not sad or have no personality. And in this case, it is immediately true that you're making a mistake. In this case, it's not immediately true that you make a mistake, but it is a mistake. And I do know a Dutch famous scientist who literally makes this mistake. I sat with him at a table for a discussion with a group of scientists. he was there. He's a famous Dutch professor. Actually, he is. This is actually a poster about the work of Daniel Dennett. That's an American philosopher. Daniel Dennett is these days in the Netherlands, I think. But I was on a table, and there were a bunch of scientists. One of them was Misha. I forgot his last name. What? Misha de Winter. Yep. He's from Utrecht, or he used to be from Utrecht. And he studies pedagogiek, children stuff. What's it? You know him or not?
No.
Oh, okay. And there was this discussion about children behavior, and this guy, this Misha, said, but there are some boys who have a very unhandy personality, and that's why they have problems in class. And this famous scientist really got angry, and he said, boys don't have a personality. Boys have a brain. And their brains have components, but these components don't have personality, so boys don't have a personality either. He really made that claim. I was there. And he's a well-respected scientist, and he made just this mistake. And I like to make such a picture to show that it's a mistake. And the second mistake is also made in that domain of brain science, since many scientists believe that if you want to understand some cognitive phenomenon, like sadness or whatever, it's important to peek into the details of our brain. It's actually quite hip thing nowadays. If you want to understand children, you need to understand their neurons. Well, that's really, you know, that's what you see in the newspapers. Neuron thing, brain stuff is very popular because of this process. The more you want to understand of something, the more you zoom into the details. It might help. It might be indeed the case that you start to understand something by peeking deeply into the details. It might also be the case that you make this mistake. You don't know in advance, but it might be a mistake to peek too much into the details of something like a brain in order to understand the whole. Well, this is all very common stuff for philosophers of science, but I like to explain this story based on these images combined with text. And I think that's a more efficient way to explain this phenomenon or explain these two mistakes than just write them down. So I think that, and that's actually, this is a very long answer on your question. Don't you always also need text? Yeah, it's very often a combination of text and images. I personally write text all the time, hardly any images, but I just try to give you some example of images since I like them. And this example, I think, is okay. You know, it's better with images than it is with just text. So in this case, yes, it was a smart move to use images instead of just text. Good example or not?
Thank you. But I'm wondering why doesn't the staff get it?
I don't know. But it might be the case that some people here don't agree with my verdict. It's very well possible. Maybe you think, hey, this Haring guy makes a huge mistake, but you don't dare to say it. That's also possible. But, well, if even Daniel Dennett is calling a scientific criminal, then I might say his name, I think. Yeah? And it's a well-known error, and the error is called greedy reductionism. And that's what I try to explain with this poster. Greed, and I've seen your finger. And what I find really cool is that these posters are printed hugely, very expensive prints, and they are exhibited in the OBA in Amsterdam for weeks, just for a wide audience, to learn them the concept of greedy reductionism. I think that's very cool. Okay.
What you say, this is a good example of a good picture. I sort of taste in your story that not everything is suitable to me.
Yeah.
So what would be a sort of a condition? Be a condition for something, better to frame it the other way around. What would make a scientific fact and process impossible?
That's very difficult. It's just actually, I don't know if you even can know in advance if you will succeed in this. It's just a matter of trying, and if you notice, I can't solve this problem, I have to write it down completely, then probably there is no graphical solution for that problem. But I don't know if you, I'm not sure if you can see those, if there are some things you know in advance. Personally, I think that if there is a complex time process, then you always need text, but you also can have a sequence of images. I don't know. I just can't answer your it's.
I don't know if I could ask it myself, but I was curious because I work in the social sciences, and then it's always much more complicated. Then you have to deal with different views.
Perspectives on. Yeah, but maybe you can even illustrate that graphically. I don't know. That's maybe possible. I don't know. Personally, I like text, but if you don't need text and you can do it more efficiently, I go for that. But I don't believe the phrase "an image says more than 1,000 words." I don't go for that, since text is just something different compared to images, and there are huge differences. Time, text has all these subtle conditions that you can put in it. If this, then that. Well, it's impossible hardly to make that graphical. But if this, then that, it's extremely simple in language. You cannot do that in a picture. It's very difficult to do that in a picture. But so the combination of text and these images is something I like. But now I go to a completely different example to um, just to show you that sometimes text in itself is enough. Yeah. I just can't go on, isn't it? There's no break or something. No. What? No. I just go on with just all kinds of examples.
Night.
What?
We're here all night.
All night? not me. Okay. I'm just looking which example shall I consider now. And the example I'm going to give now is from my last book. That's called Plastic Pandas. It's already 3 years old, or maybe 4 years old. 3 years old. And what happened there is intriguing. That's what I'm talking about. It's a book about the value of biodiversity. And actually, there are two stories that I want to share with you. First, is the reason for me to start that book is actually a metaphor used by a scientist. It was the first, January 1st, 2010, the beginning of the International Year of Biodiversity. The United Nations had declared that year the International Year for Biodiversity. And in the Dutch news, there was a biologist explaining to everyone looking at the news why the United Nations went for that. And he had in the news Jenga with him. You know, Jenga, we know that's the game with the wooden blocks. And the game is such that you have to remove a wooden block, and if nothing happens, it's fine, and you remove until everything drops down. And he said nature is like Jenga, and we are removing species from nature. And it's all fine. Nothing goes wrong. But there comes a moment, and then nature collapses, and everything is gone. And because we don't want that to happen, the United Nations declared 2010 as the International Year for Biodiversity. And I looked at that metaphor, and I thought, I don't believe it. I don't think that that is a proper metaphor. I don't believe that there really is a risk of nature collapsing because of some species to vanish. So that's one. So such a metaphor like this is extremely powerful, since it conveys a message, it tells a message, but it can be the wrong message. And that's a trick, that's a risky business of trying to find these metaphors. They can be extremely powerful in explaining something, but if you make a mistake, you explain the wrong thing. And I think that in this case, or I thought at that moment, that it was the wrong metaphor that was used at that time. It's an extremely powerful metaphor, and it's used also in biology, this metaphor of Jenga. So what happened? I started to study this stuff. That's typically something that I like, as I explained at the beginning, some complex scientific stuff. I'm an outsider. I'm not a biologist. So I start to study that, and I hope to find stories and metaphors that actually do explain the stuff in a good way. That's what I started with. And it's a whole book, a quest to the value of biodiversity. And the conclusion of the book is, well, it's maybe not nice if biodiversity declines and species get extinct, but it's not the disaster that was depicted in the news. But somewhere at the end of that quest, there was a publication in Nature with a title something like, All Species Are Important, something like that. And there was a Dutch co-author of the publication, and there was lots of media attention to that publication, and I was worried, since the conclusions of that paper were completely opposite to my conclusion, or to what I found in my quest. So, hey, there's something going on. I have to talk to the guy who co-authored that article. Luckily, the media coverage was really different than what the authors really said in their paper. They did not, in that paper, they did not claim at all that all species are required for the future of our planet or something like that. But that's just what the media made of it. But I started to talk with this guy, and he tried to explain what they actually did. And they made a meta study. And actually, why I tell you this story yeah, tell you the story to show you how difficult it is to find the proper metaphor to explain something. Yeah, that's why I tell you the story. And they did a meta study to all kinds of studies that have been done with little patches of grass. There is a whole field of biologists who study the value of biodiversity, yeah, the number of species that is around, and they do so by little patches of grass. And they influence, they control the species in these patches, and they measure all kinds of properties of those little patches of grass, and that's how they try to learn something of the relation between, well, nature and biodiversity. And the conclusion of these meta-studies that was published in Nature was that it is indeed the case that if you have a little patch of grass and you add more species to that patch of grass, that means you add more grasses, then the grasses grow higher. Then you have a little bit more biomass. You will have more grass if you have more species. And that was the conclusion of their study. But there's an effect that very fastly fades out. So if you have 10 species of grass, okay, fine. But 20 and 10 doesn't make such a difference. But still, I found that difficult to understand. Why would it be the case that if you put multiple species of grass together on a patch of land, that there is more grass growing? How would that work? I didn't understand that. And then he used the metaphor of a soccer team. He said, okay, suppose you have a soccer team with just offenders, then you won't score, since you also need a goalkeeper, or you won't win, since you also need a goalkeeper. And you need defenders, so you may need midfield players. So all these players are working together, and you have diversity in a soccer team. And only if you have diversity in a soccer team, you can, as a soccer team, win the game. Clear metaphor, isn't it? Yeah. And it really relates to his example, or to his study, to the diversity in a grass or field. In a field of grass. However, this metaphor assumes that there is cooperation between these various grass species, as there is in a soccer team. You have soccer players working together on a shared goal, but I have never heard of cooperation between grasses. That is, in my opinion, something inexistent in nature. And we concluded together that indeed the metaphor of a soccer team is an incorrect metaphor. And it's very important, since this metaphor is used very often. And people understand the value of diversity because of such metaphors. But the metaphor is a wrong metaphor. There is no cooperation between species or between plant species. That's not existent. There is some cooperation between fungi and plants, or cooperation of two species of animals and plants and that kind of stuff, but there's no cooperation of, say, 10 different plants together, working together. That's just non-existent. So we came up with a new metaphor. It's a very complex metaphor, but I think that this metaphor explains stuff better. Yeah? And let's just try it out. I wrote it down. This is typically a metaphor that you have to use text for. It's a textual metaphor. And I think that this metaphor is a better one, but maybe it's way off. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to explain in metaphorical terms why it is logical that if you put more grasses in a patch of land, that there will grow more grass. Yeah. And the metaphor of a soccer team is not the proper metaphor. The metaphor that I would use is the following. It uses a pantry. A pantry is a voorraadkast. Yeah, a pantry, that's a cupboard in the kitchen. And it's full with stuff that you can use to cook. Yeah? And say that the pantry, that there's all kinds of ingredients in the pantry. And the pantry it stands for the nutrients that are in the patch of land. Yeah? So in the soil. And nutrients are just stuff that plants need. Yeah? So the pantry is a metaphor for, well, nutrients in the ground. And suppose that you have, suppose you have this pantry, and you have a couple of friends who pass by unexpectedly, and you have to cook for them, and it's a lot of friends, and you have only one recipe, there's only one thing you can cook, pancakes, then you cannot cook very much for your friends. Since suppose that you have 6 eggs, and you have some flour and milk or whatever, but you can use that from the pantry to cook for your friends, but that's it. Now, the anchovies you cannot use, the potatoes you cannot use, since you don't know, you cannot cook with them. And a recipe is a metaphor for a species. So, given this metaphor, it's clear that if you have one recipe, you cannot cook the pantry empty. There will always remain stuff in the pantry that you cannot use to cook, since you have only so few recipes. But if you have more recipes, you have the opportunity to empty the pantry completely. Since, well, you do have a recipe for anchovies, and you can use all the ingredients of the pantry to completely empty it for your friends. This is clear, isn't it? So this metaphor, I think, does explain why more recipes helps you to empty the pantry. And this metaphor explains that more species of grass, well, will allow more grass to grow, since what is the growing of grass? It's a translation, or these grasses require nutrients, and the more different grasses you have, the more different compositions of nutrients from the soil can be used to grow grass from. And this metaphor does not at all imply cooperation. So this is a proper metaphor, I would think, but it's maybe a complex one. Is it a clear metaphor to you?
I'm not sure if I really understand why the grass grows higher then.
Well, it's just more grass. Well, it's just more biomass. Yeah, so if you then, what do these scientists? They just cut the grass, and they extract the water from it, and they weigh it. And it's just more weight. More biomass, and more biomass is good. Well, it can be a measure for quality. And the tricky thing is, or at least for me the tricky thing is, that the intuition of many lay people is that there is cooperation. Nature is a cooperative thing, and we all work together, and all these species work together, and if some species get out of this cooperation idea, then trouble happens. But there is no cooperation, and then you need to find other metaphors that explain how things happen. Yeah.
The funny thing is that an ecosystem is often used as a metaphor for teams, football teams.
Yeah.
Because of the cooperative.
Yeah, which is really ridiculous. Biologists will never say that. Because they know what an ecosystem is. It's just a bunch of egoists. And they do profit from each other, but it's not really cooperation. You do see cooperation in nature, but it's always with only 2 species or maybe 3 species. It's never with 100 species working all together into a shared goal. There is no shared goal in nature. It's
same goes with the Dutch soccer team.
Ah, but the Dutch soccer team has a shared goal, but you don't cooperate enough, possibly. Yeah, but they do have a shared goal. So in this, and I wrote down this metaphor, and I was pleased with it, and I think it's a better metaphor than a cooperative soccer team. I still don't know if it succeeded, since it's maybe too complex. But actually, I understand stuff better via that metaphor. Yeah. Well, the recipe stands for a species. I'm not sure yet. I have to think about that. Yeah, I'm not sure yet. I have to think about that. Okay, let's quit it for now, yeah? or at least this. Yeah, I go to the next. I'm just giving you examples. Yeah, just examples of stuff I like. And I'm going to the next metaphor. And this story explains what they mean for me, since I understand stuff via metaphors. That's how I understand stuff. That's what understanding means for me. And that's why I write books. I have some topic I don't understand. I hope I start to understand it by writing about it. I find a metaphor that does its job. I write it down to help myself. And luckily, other people like those metaphors and they also understand stuff. So that's why I have this job. And one of the nice metaphors I think that I, met recently is in the new topic I'm now in, economics. It's a, for me, a completely new field. Well, it was a new field 3 years ago. This weekend I will have a book finished about economics. Possibly a week later, but I have to hand it in this weekend. And the name of the book will be Why Coke is More Expensive Than Milk, which is really something strange. Why should Coke be more expensive than milk? Milk is way cooler stuff than Coke. Nevertheless, Coke is more expensive in the supermarket. But one of the, and it's a bunch of questions, naive questions, about the field of economics. And I'm really, I've never had economics at high school, nothing. And one of the questions is the question, why is the interest around 5%? It's just a question I wrote down. That was the strategy for that book. I just wrote down 30 questions, and I started to study those questions. And I started to study economics in order to understand that stuff better. Because I think many lay people don't understand that field actually properly. And in that field, they're very bad in explaining what it's about. You know, economics, people from economists typically don't explain the essence of their academic field, I think. So I had, a bunch of questions. One of these questions was, why is the interest about around 5%? And people might respond, the interest is not 5%, it's now 0% or 1% or something like that. But nevertheless, if you look in time, it's very often it's around 5% already for 200 years. Why is that? It's an extremely complex story, actually, why the interest is around 5%. I would think somehow my intuition would be, money is something like, you had the example of rabbits. What money is rabbits? If you have two rabbits, and it's a man and a woman, then over time you will get more rabbits just by itself. They multiply themselves, yeah? And also a forest. If you have a forest, it's an amount of wood. If you wait, it will become more wood because it grows. The same holds for money. It's somehow just by itself, it will grow, it will get, you will get more of it, and that's interest. That's my extreme naive intuition. This is not, you're laughing. Do you, now you, did you have the same intuition when you was a kid or not? Yeah? But what is your intuition about interest now then?
I'm not sure if I have an intuition about interest.
Where does it come from, the interest of 5%? But what would be your rational explanation?
That you can use money to make more money.
Okay, but then you can use money to make more money.
Yes.
Okay, that's actually already in. That's getting close to the example of the forest growing or chicken to become more chicken.
If you have to use money.
Yeah, it's not the proper answer, or at least I would. My verdict would be that I would not accept it as a proper answer. And because I know another answer, using a metaphor for trees, that makes it extremely clear, at least it makes it clear to me. And the core insight is the following. Suppose that I'm going to publish this book, and I ask you now to buy the book already. I suppose that you do that. And you know the book is going to cost 20 euros. Maybe some of you are willing to pay 20 euros now for me, yeah? Possibly, I guess. But then something happens, and the book will not be published this year, but in 3 years from now. that's thinkable. Then you feel screwed. You say, okay, I paid this guy 20 euros, but I will get the book only in 3 years from now. Yeah, you won't like that. Possibly, if I tell you now beforehand that this book will only be available in 3 years, and it will cost 20 euros, you will be willing to give me some money today. But not 20 euros. I think you will pay me 17 euros or so. Okay, 17 euros today is fine. I have the book in 3 years. But if you pay 17 euros now, you will get a book in 3 years from now that is worth 20 euros. There's a 3% difference. Where does it come from? Interest. This is what interest is. What is the tree metaphor explaining this to me, at least? It was, suppose that you want to buy a tree, an apple tree. Why would you buy it? Well, not because of the tree itself, but because of the apples. Yeah, you're not interested in the tree, you're interested in the apples. Suppose you want to buy an apple tree. Apple trees last for 100 years. So what would be the logical amount of apples to pay for an apple tree? Well, 100 times the yearly oogst. What's the word for that?
Harvest,
yeah. So for an apple tree, you typically would pay, naively, I would say, 100 apple harvests, since you know that an apple tree will give apples 100 years. Yeah, clear, isn't it? However, the apples that will be given to you in the future, in a year from now, have less value than the apples that you will get immediately. The apples a year after will have even less value, and the apples thereafter will also have less value, just because of the phenomenon I explained to you with this book. A book that's with a price of 20 euros in the future has a value of only 17 euros today, or something like it, I don't know. Yeah. It has less value today than it has in the future. So also, the apple harvests in the future will have less value translated to today. So typically, as a sort of psychological phenomenon, people don't pay 100 apple harvests for one apple tree. They pay about 20. It's a psychological effect. You know, that's how we value the future. If I have an apple tree that produces apples from now on until infinity, I'm not going to pay an infinite amount of apples. I typically pay, as a psychological phenomenon, 20 apple harvests. That's how I value the future. But if I pay 20 apple harvests now, then I will get for that every year one apple harvest. And it's 1/20, 5%. And that's why interest is 5%. You pay something now that will have an effect in the future, and because we discount the future, we will have a difference between the discount and what we paid now, and that's the interest. It's a different story than the answer you give, isn't it?
It is, but you can make with the money you buy the equity now money in future.
Yeah, but
you
yeah. Yeah, but the essential difference between the way you phrased it and the way it's phrased like I do now is this time difference, that you're not really making money with the money. No, because you're paying less for something you get in the future, there's a difference between what you pay now and what you get in the future, and that difference is the essence of interest. This metaphor of this apple tree helped me enormously. It's not a metaphor I came up with myself. It's a metaphor by Irving Fisher, who is an economist and made this metaphor up in the beginning of the 20th century. But it helped me tremendously. I now understand something essential of this field of economics, that I now understand the reason of interest. I also now understand that some of my friends who claim interest is a bad thing, we should get rid of it, that they are untrue. I mean, how the heck would you get rid of the phenomenon that we judge the future less than we judge, well, today? I mean, it's not something you can get rid of. So my friend saying interest is a bad thing, and I understand that that's not something that you can easily say. So this, again, is a metaphor that helps to explain something complex. This metaphor helped me understanding it, and it also helps me understand that people, other people don't understand. Is it clear or not? Yeah.
I just wondered this effect of that things get less value. I can't repeat it exactly as you say, but that's value difference.
Yeah.
And you were saying that this is a psychological...
It's a psychological phenomenon, yeah.
Yes. So if your friends say you should get rid of...
Interest?
Then actually they're saying... I don't know.
They are saying the future should have as much value as today.
Yes, but so this interest, so the, let's say at the core of this interest thing is a psychological phenomenon.
Yeah. And it depends on the age we get, for example.
Sorry?
That depends on our age. We get typically 80 years. And that defines this 5. Then if we would get 200 years, interest would be lower. If we would get, if one day flies, I don't know if that's a word, eendagsvliegen, they will have a huge interest compared to our interest, since 5% per year is zero for them in their lives. They won't accept that. They will use interest of billions percentages per year.
What is
it's logical.
In relation to that, I also wonder why we live in this accumulating system.
Yeah.
Things get more work, and therefore companies need to have more interest.
Okay. Is there a... Okay. Choose between the two options. Here, you get my iPhone. There it is in front of you. Yeah. This is option one.
Yes.
Now give it back, please. Option two, it's here. Which one do you prefer?
This one.
Yeah, there. It's close by. Well, this is space, but you have the same in time. The closer it is in time, the cooler. It's so fundamental. I don't think it's something you can get rid of.
I think it's also maybe got something to do with a perceived risk that you won't get it.
Yeah.
If you put it away tomorrow,
yeah,
only get it in 3 years.
That's one, a perceived risk, or maybe you don't exist anymore in the future. So, there are all kinds of reasons. But, you know, this is a little bit off topic, maybe, this interest metaphor. But it is something I really, again, like. It's not a metaphor by myself. It's a purely textual metaphor. I don't think you can make this graphical easily. And I think that the story itself explains something. At least it helped me understanding something. And these metaphors are really cool in explaining science for many people, since it helps so tremendously understand complex stuff. But it's extremely difficult to really find the proper ones. But I think it's extremely cool. Yeah, the strange thing is that the evolution is in itself something very simple. Mm-hmm. You know, it is so simple that once Darwin, you know, published his book for the first time, there were some biologists who said, "How is it possible that we did not see that?" You know, that Aristoteles just didn't think of it in an afternoon. It's so simple. It's such a simple process. How can we have overlooked it for centuries? Well, the process is very simple, so there are simple metaphors available to explain the essence of this process. In economics, it's not always like that. Stuff are sometimes complex. Moreover, what's difficult in economics is that lay people have all kinds of ideas of the words used in economics. And they, for example, if I talk about interest, and I used it. I tried this with my students. Said, "Yeah, but then this thing, inflation, And economic growth, how does that relate to interest? And it makes it very complex, you know. You have all these other terms that people also associate with your concept, and then it's very difficult to stick with the original small metaphor that explains the stuff so neatly. Do we have more time?
Yes.
Yeah? Then I just give you some other examples. Just some more examples, yeah? And the next example is... Oh, you have a question.
Yeah?
Is a very different way of explaining science. It's done by a scientist here in Utrecht, who I find very inspiring. But it's also a very strange scientist. And it's, in my opinion, a very cool way of addressing scientific insight to a wide audience. And this is the example I wish to show to you. Actually, this you can see this stuff in the University Museum of the Utrecht University, in the depot in the Uithof. At the Uithof, they have a depot with all kind of dentistry stuff, and there they also have this amongst a shitload of other stuff. I was there a couple of years ago. I got a tour through this depot, and I saw all kinds of dentistry stuff, like skulls that students work on, and these drills, all kinds of drills that they use. And then at one moment, Reina de Raad, who is the curator there, opened a drawer, and in the drawer was this and some other stuff. And this is work made by the dean of the dentistry, of the dentist faculty of this university in the 70s. His name is Guus Vleugel, and he used to be the dean, yeah? Professor, and he was specialized in dentures, kunstgebitten. And he had the opinion that in his field, some assumptions were not studied enough yet. So he wanted to say to his colleagues and to the wide audience, please doubt whatever your dentist says, since it's not well studied enough. And one of the things that he argued against was the use of dentures. I mean, he was a denture specialist, professor in denturology, or whatever you call it, but he thought that dentures were too easily used at his time. Actually, I do have friends whose parents have their teeth removed when they got married. And it was just a custom, yeah? You remove the healthy teeth, and it's good, we give you a denture, that's easy, yeah? You're staring at me like that, but it's really a custom. It used to be a custom. Once you grow 25, we remove all your healthy teeth, we give you a denture, done, easy. Well, he opposed to that custom. And he thought dentures need better study. But how to tell that? And the regular form to do so is write a scientific article saying we need to study dentures more. But no one read his scientific articles. That's what happens with scientific articles. So he opted for something else. And one of the things he made is this. So this is a denture with a large schroef and a bolt. A nut and a bolt is something you call it. And here is a picture of a colleague of him with the same nut on his head, suggesting that there was a hole through the skull, and now it's fixed. Yeah. One of the problems with dentures is that it's difficult to fix them. So this denture works. Is the claim that he wants his project to say. And I spoke to the guy. He is, I don't know if he's still living, but a year ago he was, but he's 95 or so. And so he was a professor in this field. And if he looks back at his life, he says, this was my most important scientific publication. This is way more important than the articles I've wrote. This is the kind of stuff I had effect with. And this work traveled all over the world, was seen in the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, was seen in Zeist, not too far from here, at an exhibition, was traveled to Los Angeles for an exhibition, and actually colleagues of Guus Vleugel agree that indeed, with works like these, he influenced, one, the opinion of the general public, but two, also the opinion of his colleague academics. And this is not a metaphor explaining something, but at least it's a different form to explain or to communicate a scientific idea or insight, and I like that very much. So this is something I find very cool. And I just an example. This is not the kind of stuff I make myself. I cannot do that. I don't want to do that. I mean, making stuff such that people understand complex concepts, but this is also something that I envy. Well, this is rather cool. He went further, by the way. Any questions about this or not? Yeah. Difficult to say. In the 70s, the role of art was different, I think, than it is nowadays. And, I'm not in that field, but... Yeah, it was definitely so. He had art friends, and he did really his best to get it in the Stedelijk Museum. Yeah, and he envied artists. I go show you this work on the right. That goes even further than the previous work. So it's now talk a little bit about this one. This is Guus Vleugel, this one, and he wanted to make the following claim, or the following statement. He said, okay, dentures are not studied well enough. And maybe dentures are not so good for you. But it's also possible the other way around, he said. It might be so that in some cases, dentures are better for you than normal, healthy teeth, natural teeth. But it's impossible to study that in a controlled experiment. You're not going to do that. You're not going to remove healthy teeth for scientific research. But you can do so with cows, he said. So here we have a cow, and the teeth from the cow are removed, and that cow is given this denture, this kunstgebit, and the production of the milk of the cow is measured over time, and he shows that milk production goes up. And he presented this work at various scientific conferences, claiming that in this case, a denture is good. Maybe not for the cow, but good for milk production. But he never did this study. This is a performance he did on scientific conferences. But the colleagues at the scientific conferences didn't understand that. They didn't know that it was just a performance. They thought that he really removed the healthy teeth from that cow, and that he really, that his graphs of increase in milk production were indeed real graphs. But it was all a performance. And that is really something that we would not allow anymore today. You know, this is scientific fraud. Nevertheless, it is quite an intriguing way, I would say, to communicate a scientific idea. And I find that very peculiar, that this dean of the faculty dared to even do this kind of stuff in order to convey his ideas. And again, if he looks back at his career, he claims that these works are way more important than his regular academic works. And I find it inspiring. At least this case can inspire other people to once in a while try another form than the scientific article. Maybe you can have effect in due time. It's very well possible. That's it. Enough examples? I do have one example left, but I'm skip that. I don't do it anymore. Fine? Yeah. We have weekend? Good. But if you have questions, it's fine. But I'm not going to show any more examples. Yeah. You wrote them down.
But then what perception of science.
And an understanding of science, really. That's,
The understanding of science and the role of that. So I'm Marlika and I work at Kennisland in Amsterdam, which is a public think tank, boot tank. I'm a researcher there. I worked at NWO and at Utrecht University, and I really wonder, should scientists just give the knowledge, and is it up to the society to interpret it? Or is communicating science the role and the responsibility of the researcher? And if so,
but this is
like
not the same question.
Sorry?
This is not the same question. You said it's, or if I interpret your first question correctly, then you ask, is the responsibility of a scientist to communicate scientific insights, or also to interpret it in societal terms, or the relevance of these insights?
Yeah, you're right. These are two different things. And also, if you think, well, let's talk about the communication and not of the interpretation. If you think it is the role of the researcher, should there not be better incentives for example, NWO or Utrecht University to, you are given a very special position with this professorship.
Yeah.
Other professors are maybe struggling a little bit more and would want to have that space. But so what's your idea?
I think that you should take all those incentives with a grain of salt. You have your own responsibility in life.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, you're helped with incentives. But at the end of the day, you have to look in the mirror yourself. And you have to, and the only real incentive is what you want to do in your life, I would say. So it's fine, all those incentives trying to steer people in some directions. But my colleagues who say, oh, I'd love to write an article in a newspaper, but I cannot do so because my age index and... okay, well, you listen to those incentives yourself. You are the boss of your life. Say, screw the age index and do whatever you really want to do and look what happens. And my... Actually, when I see colleagues doing this, you know, doing the same stuff as I do, actually, they are tolerated again at university. They're never kicked out of the university because of this. Naturally, you must be successful in that field. You know, if you write a newspaper article and you say, I prefer that compared to a scientific article, then it must be an okay newspaper article. I must say, I do know a case in which it did not go in this way, and it's the case of the philosopher who is on Sunday morning on TV, Ad Verbrugge. Ad Verbrugge is not a professor in philosophy. He was supposed to be the new professor of philosophy at the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam, but he is not, because he shows on TV, he's doing all those relevant stuff, and we want his board want him to be more academic. So he is an example of someone who is screwed by the incentives. But my first response would be, it's your own responsibility.
And a second question, do you see other forms than images developing in your field? So I can see that, for example, podcast is a growing medium to communicate science. Do you see other media forms?
Yeah, naturally. Podcasts are also text. Yeah, and the intriguing stuff is the really, really different forms. Like the famous... or I think the well-known dances that science now initiates. Dance Your PhD. It's a contest by the magazine Science, and it asks PhD students to dance their PhD, and that's a really different form. Yeah, you dance as a way of communication, and it's not working. You know, I've never seen a PhD thesis that is danced properly. But nevertheless, it's cool to try that form. Or I personally like installations in public spaces. And for this economics book that is finished this weekend, I got money by the Mondrian Fonds to hire an artist making stuff on the street around the theme of economics. And that's a form I really like, which like people, well, they do activities, you know, the economic activities are on the street or in a shop. So that's where you should give the information, at the street or in a shop. And that's not a podcast. So that's also a form, so installations in public spaces or things that really involve you, like games. Well, that's a well-known form. I've seen a PhD thesis as a comic. I got that yesterday, I believe. So comic as a form is also intriguing. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of...
I've seen a documentary, the Collaboration of Knowledge Paradigm.
Yeah.
That one, could that count? Or?
A documentary is also quite textual, I would say. And also, well, clearly, the documentary is fine, but it's not really... I think that's... Way cooler forms are thinkable. For example, the actions that are done, but it's typically artists who do this, maybe though Kurt van Mensvoort. Kurt van Mensvoort is an artist who is inspired by science, and he's also a computer scientist. He is also an assistant professor, so he is also a scientist, but he's also a designer. He wanted to make a claim... I wanted to say something about the border of nature and artificial stuff. And he initiated a sort of hoax that lasted for a year. And in this hoax, people were invited. There was a website, and this website was for a company. And this company invited people to buy boots made by rayfish skin. That is possible, to buy boots made of rayfish skin. And you could genetically manipulate the skin of the rayfish. You could say, I want purple dots on a pink background with these and these forms. And this company would genetically modify rayfish such that the skin would be like you wished. And a year after, you would get your boots. So that was a company. But besides the company, there were all kinds of organizations responding to that company. There was a fight. There was some animal activists entered the company and made it go bankrupt in the end. This was all faked. Also, the responses on the company. So this was a huge happening that was all staged. With a tremendous effect. Such happenings are also a very cool form to communicate science, I think. And you can consider that, to do such things. And it's way more active than just a story. Mm-hmm. But it's typically artists who do so and not scientists, yeah.
If you communicate science for the public to understand it, but this dentist probably also had a political message.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I work at the Rata Institute.
Yeah.
And we present reports that everybody must understand, but that also have this double, both aim for public as well as political understanding.
Yeah.
We don't have the, what we do, it's not always in terms of pictures. So I was wondering if you develop such a thing like this to promote the public understanding, do you have some
Well, not me. You know, I'm not making this kind of stuff. I'm just intrigued by it because it's such a different form. I find this Guus Vleugel guy intriguing as a person, and I like this kind of work since it's so different. But I would never do that. I'm a very humble guy. You know, I just take some scientific content made by others, and I just try to find a story such that lay people understand it. That's my work. And I don't have any political goal with that, except that the topics that I choose are such that they are relevant for a large audience. This guy clearly had a political reason. And actually, how old are you?
29.
29, okay. I'm 47. When I was 47, it was for if you ate a candy, you had to brush your teeth immediately. That was the rule. Brush your teeth as often as possible. Was not studied. Now it's not like that anymore. Now we know you have to brush your teeth only twice a day. Because of also Guus Vleugel, who changed his opinion. He said to the to politics and to his colleagues, come on guys, study your recommendations. You are training those poor kids to brush their teeth dozens of times a day. Do you know if it has any effect, yes or no? That was a political aim he had. And he succeeded in that since things changed. Yeah, but it's only, yeah, but I'm quite autistic in this kind of stuff, you know. In the selection of my topic, it is indeed that the relevance of the topic counts, but in the way I eventually phrase it or depict it, I have no political aims at all. I just want them to understand stuff better. And that's my job. I'm really autistic in that, you know. That's it, and that's my influence. And actually, it's maybe okay to do it like that. Yeah.
Isn't what you're doing and what Guus Vleugel was doing not a political? Does not have a direct political agenda, but it's more a philosophy of science.
Yeah.
Point where Guus said, guys, you have to study what you advise, and you say, hey, we have this understanding of the world. It's very fundamental, it has to be understood differently.
Yeah, that is something that's true, yeah. But that's then long-term politics, I would say. That's not, yeah, it's a more societal role that you give yourself.
And then, next to that, are you familiar with the work of Bruno Latour?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we consider the ecosystem not to be of a cooperative thing, but more of a very complex system, which is hard to understand, would it be also possible for you or Cole to come up with a metaphor for the very complex idea that Bruno Latour writes down in his book?
Yeah, but that's a social scientist. Mm-hmm. And normally what I did until now is that I take a mechanism from a more natural, in a more natural science field, and that mechanism I try to explain via metaphors. But in going now for economics, I'm leaving the natural sciences a little bit. So maybe in the future, even other processes are considerable for me. But up till now, I stuck to the more just the mechanisms as they run in nature, and not something like a process as Bruno Latour describes.
And if you switch these disciplines, what is your thoughts then on Joris Luyendijk examining as an anthropologist,
yeah,
in the city of London the economic crisis?
Well, actually, when we started our projects at the same time, so we were in the beginning of these projects, we were invited sometimes together to say things. Well, his book sold 300,000 copies, I believe, and I don't know what my book will do, but I have a really different approach, and that's why I use this word autistic. He describes the people, and it's a journalistic approach. I want to understand how stuff works. So I want to know the core essence of interest. And it's more a scientific approach to stuff. You know, I just like to understand that. And we have all kinds of opinions about it. Or where does money come from? It's really very complex. Or economic growth, what the heck does it mean? That's the kind of stuff I want to understand. And I see that as my job. And we do really, Joris Luyendijk really did something else. He from a cultural, actually, it resembles this last project resembles a little bit the book by the Bill Bryson book, Everything, the Short History of Nearly Everything, yeah, by Bill Bryson. Bill Bryson is a travel writer, actually, had no clue about the natural sciences, really nothing, and he just gave himself the duty, I'm going to write a book about the natural sciences, since that's so cool, I don't know nothing about it. And that's more kind of my agenda in this economics book. But it's a different agenda as Joris Luijendijk has, to my regret, otherwise it would also have sold 300,000 copies. Yeah.
7 euro.
Yeah. Yeah.
The question, how do you conceive of your public? So do you choose children books or make it as simple? So, because Joris Luijendijk also famously said, he wanted to explain the financial crisis to his nephew, who was 4. So that's a form of to approach the public as a child. Or
yeah.
And it has to be very easily understood, although it's very complex. How do you approach it?
Well, actually, when I started this work, I wrote this children book, yeah, of which you saw 2 images. And actually, I did never intend to write it for someone else. I just intended to write it for myself, such that I understand stuff better. So my audience is myself, and apparently I'm extremely childish, so that's why it's understandable. You know, I just want to understand it myself, and I like to simplify things very much such that I can remember them. And that's why I have this virtual audience of young people. But actually, if I give talks about books, my audience is always vrouwen van middelbare leeftijd. That's a middle-aged woman. But that's not the audience I have in mind when I write a book. But that's apparently how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah, what is your opinion on the science communication of the large national newspapers in the Netherlands, and maybe their use of metaphors to explain that they have?
Well, newspapers have a very specific goal. They want to communicate the news. And and there's a lot of news in science. You know, we know this, and the day after we know that, and there's this experiment, and it shows blah, and it goes on. It's a continuously. Well, we know more than we knew before. And newspapers try to deal with that, and to communicate about that. But they do it properly, I would say. I'm dealing with really something else. That's some larger insights that only 1 in 5 years you will find something else. You know, this question about interest is solved in 1907, and that's it. And then it takes again 20 years before we have a new insight. So I'm dealing with different stuff, and newspapers typically don't have a reason to use metaphors to explain stuff, since they are not in explaining stuff. They're just in communicating what we know now compared to what we knew yesterday. And it's a different, that's something else, I would say. Sometimes newspapers need to explain something, like when we found
the gravitational
waves. Yeah. That's and then you typically see that there's a discrepancy between a science journalist and a scientist. If you ask the scientist to explain it, he or she probably fails. If you ask the journalist to explain it, he or she probably fails too. And you need someone who is able to, on the one hand, understand really the essence of what's going on, and is able to communicate it neatly. So what I would then suggest to newspapers is try to find someone who really can do this. And for example, Vincent Eeke is quite reasonable sometimes in this. He is in physics. He is also in. He knows his forms. So he, for some topics, he could be invited to explain it to a wide audience. He typically would do that. But that's not what newspapers want. They want their own journalists to write about it, and that very often fails. Or it's not helping me understanding stuff. For example, the Majorana particle. You remember that? I never realized, and it was not explained to me in the newspaper, that particle is has a very specific meaning. Now, if you have something that has a number of properties, then you are allowed to use the word particle. But the Majorana particle is a cloud of particles. Did you know that? That the Majorana particle is not a particle in the way we conceive particles? It's not like an electron or a proton or so. The Majorana particle is so large, it consists of lots of other particles. But because it has some properties, it may be called particle. That was never explained to me in the newspapers. They said to me, we have a new particle. Well, that depends on a very specific definition of what a particle is. It's not explained to me. And typically there, things go wrong, I would say. I just remember this case. Yeah. I don't know the exact size of the Majorana particle, but I believe it's something like 20 centimeters or so.
If it's this big, why didn't they see it before?
That's the strange. Such a particle, this Majorana particle, is a concept that has some properties, and these properties were never created. So they created something with the properties of a Majorana particle, and then you have observed the Majorana particle, but it's not something that is around and can be observed. It was really something else than I thought. Are we done?
No one else.
Yeah, you can go ahead. I'm not gone yet.
Do you think, as it is portrayed in newspapers or wherever you can get a grip of science, if you're not a scientist, is there a possibility to get to know the differences between biology and astronomy, so the types of disciplines?
Again.
So if you're not a scientist,
yeah.
Never been to university before, this is my dad.
Yeah.
You've been to university before, but I don't think, do you know the difference between the way they work in economics and the way they work in biology?
Ah, so it's, okay.
Also more of a two
And you ask me if I think that they can understand it.
Yeah, or should it be explained more?
Actually, I'm going to show you one more little movie. you don't need to go, do you? I'm really a fan of the program Proefkonijnen. Anyone of you have seen that program? Who has not? Okay. It was a program where I have a very small role in that TV program. I'm going to show you the first 30 seconds of that program. Yeah, that's okay, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't find it. It's not. Oh, and my computer is gone. Yeah. No, I can't. It says 0%. But I need the novel charger.
Yeah, it has a double one.
Oh, good, yeah.
So I think it should
work. But I have to reboot my computer now since, it really, I've never seen that before, 0%. No, that's true. It's turning red.
Yeah,
sometimes you have to wait for a couple of minutes before. Well, I just talk about the program anyway, and maybe I can show you the first 30 seconds. 4 years ago, BNN, Dutch popular broadcasting organization, asked if I wanted to join a popular scientific program they were making. And first of all, BNN is very popular, and that's risky. Ah, it does work. Whoa. 1%. Movies. Proefkonijnen. This is the first 30 seconds of that scientific program. Yeah. Full screen. Oh, this way. Wait. The sound is not working. Yeah, but now I think it is.
Welkom bij de allereerste aflevering van het nieuwe wetenschapsprogramma van BNM, Proefkonijnen.
Ja, dames en heren, en die proefkonijnen, dat zijn wij. Lichaam en goede naam. Gooi je er in de strijd allemaal voor de wetenschap.
Okay, this does not feel as a scientific program, does it? This is a popular show hosted by these very popular young guys, and you see these half-naked women on stage. This does not at all feel as a popular scientific program. That's why I was hesitating to be part of this program. I have a little role on the side. But actually, I'm very pleased with it, since essentially, this is way more scientific than the other scientific programs, I think. Because what they do in this program, they ask the questions themselves, and they study them themselves. For example, what they did, they had the question, can you, as a man, experience how painful it is to give birth to a child? Can you experience that? And typically, if you would ask that question in a regular scientific program, then the journalist would go to a scientist who then tells all kinds of interesting knowledge about the experience of pain or whatever, and what happens in your body if blah, 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 blah. But what they do, they just really try to experience it themselves. Just in this particular case, they had a little, well, electrical charge thing on their belly that gave a little, it caused the muscles in the belly to contract. These contractions were supposed to resemble possibly Barensweeën, I don't know what that. What? Contractions? Yeah, okay. And and it's unclear. And Valerio, one of the two guys, can stand this for 2 minutes. The other one for the complete 2 hours that was anticipated. And that second guy really felt extreme pain. And a scientist observing his behavior says, I cannot see in his head, but I cannot peek into his head. But it seems his behavior is like the behavior of women giving birth to a child. And what I do like of this approach is that it decreases the distance between science and really non-scientific lay people. These people have just high school, or something like that. They are not highly educated, and they understand that science is something that everyone can do, and just by doing it themselves. And this is actually something that teaches people what do these scientists do? And what is the difference between an astronomer and an economist? Is the only way to really experience that is by becoming an astronomer for one day, or try to become an economist for one day and see what these people do. And that's actually what they do. And at the end of 4 years making this program, you really can see that they progressed scientifically. At one stage, it's really a cool happening, I think. Dennis stopped the program, and it's something that will never happen. If it stopped, it's always stopped by the director or a cameraman or something goes breaks, but never by Dennis nor Valerio. Dennis stopped while they were doing some experiment, a boring experiment in the studio. They had a pool with water, and they were inputting salt, and they wanted to know how much salt should we put in the water before someone floats on the water. Boring experiment. You can look it up at the Wikipedia, so it's boring, but nevertheless. In the middle of the experiment, Dennis said, stop, I want to stop. There is a guy besides the pool. In a while, he will go in the water to test how much salt we should put in the water. But maybe it's a very strange guy. I want to know if he floats in water without salt. And I want to do that because it's a scientific program. If I make a claim on TV, I want to know that this claim is true. I don't want to fool myself. This is a scientific program. Science means that I need to trust my own answers. Hence, I want to know what kind of guy that is. And he learned that over time. So a little bit, he became a scientist just by doing it. And I really like that approach. And it's actually my long answer on your question. Yes, I believe that lay people can understand the difference between all those disciplines by just becoming a scientist a little bit and trying it themselves. And this is an example of shrinking the distance between what these people do and lay people, instead of making it larger. Since the more serious scientific programs, they make the distance to science larger. Like, ooh, it's so fancy what they do, and they're so smart, and it's so complex. Well, if that is your approach, then you will never understand the difference between an economist and an astronomer. But if you do this, you start to learn those differences. I'm done with it. Fine weekend.
Thanks for sticking with us till the end. The next guest lecturer will be Frank Miedema, one of the founders of the Science in Transition movement in the Netherlands. Until then, happy perceptions!